What do you know about counterfactuals? They're key to entrepreneurial imagination and the customer's value learning experience.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hey, Hunter Hastings here. Entrepreneurs imagine the future, and then they make it happen. It's what they do. And guess what? Your customers spend a lot of time imagining the future, too. They have to. If you're making them a proposition, you want them to try your service or buy from you when they never have before, how do they know they'll get satisfaction? How do they know your service will solve the problem they want solving, or give them a good customer experience, and not make them feel disappointed or take it in because the experience you promised is not what they expected? Their only tool is imagining that future. Dr. Mark Packard is here with us again today, and his research reveals this amazing capability of the human mind that he calls counterfactuals. We can imagine experiences we haven't had yet. We can feel the joy, we can feel the pain. I'll tell you a story I've told Mark. On my bike ride, there's a steep little hill just before my house. It's nasty, brutish, and thankfully short. About halfway through my ride, I start counterfactually imagining the ascent up that last hill. I can feel the shortness of breath, the lactic acid pain in the thighs, the yes-I-can determination I will have to call on to get to the top. And I'm not even there yet. But it hurts. It's counterfactual. It's amazing. Now project that analogy to the consumer or business-to-business customer who is considering your offer. They draw on that same counterfactual mental process, imagination, to decide whether to accept it or not, and to decide what price to pay compared to alternatives. Then to frame the actual experience against what it might have been like under an alternative scenario. It's amazing the counterfactuals they sort through. But they do. Mark is our leading expert in this space of economic counterfactuals. He's giving us an MBA class combining brain science with entrepreneurship. You can't afford to miss it. He's here today for the third installment of his value learning process class, and he's going to give us some new tools we can use to apply it in our businesses. Mark is assistant professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, where he teaches strategic management, entrepreneurship, and innovation. Mark, welcome back to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Hey, Hunter.
So over several episodes, you're going to help us walk entrepreneurs and business people through the thinking and the tools that compose the value learning process. And that's a process you've developed from your own original research. And the purpose of it is to help entrepreneurs unlock customer experiences or consumer experiences that have the highest value in the customer's mind. And therefore, the entrepreneur is going to have a better chance to capture more of that value, i.e. make a better revenue and more profit. So today we're going to cover a couple of new tools and insights, but let's give everybody a baseline of the value learning process and the basic steps in it.
Right. Okay. So again, the goal of entrepreneurship is kind of, as you were saying, to discover what customers really value and need, and to devise a more effective solution to those needs than what they already have now. So what we've been doing is trying to figure out how to learn what customers really need. And we've seen so far that it's really not all that easy a task, largely because customers don't always know exactly what they need. You know, they have some ideas about it, but those are really hard to pin down. And so we've been going through this theoretical cycle. And if you look at your life in particular, we're all as customers in this learning cycle throughout our lives, incrementally learning what satisfies us. But sometimes we have a hard time translating what we consume and the satisfactions we feel and the kind of the uneasiness and that we feel into a real knowledge of how and why those satisfactions work and what would better satisfy us. So in my work, I introduced in the previous episode, this value learning cycle, which, as you know, has five steps. The first step was predictive value. What will the experience be like if I consume something? And then step two is relative value. Okay, comparing that predicted experience, how does it compare to other solutions that exist on the market that I know of or have tried, and comparing those, because again, there's that opportunity cost that if you pay for something, you're giving up something else. The third step is exchange value, right? So you're putting a price tag on that solution, what you're willing to pay. So if the price is this, that's or less, I'm willing to pay that based on that prediction of value. And if you do buy something, then the next thing is experience value. Once you consume it, you experience that value firsthand. And finally, after consuming, you have the fifth step, the value assessment, where you compare that value that you actually experienced to what you predicted it would be and learn from any difference there.
Perfect. So that's the baseline, the five steps of the value learning cycle. There's a process map of that associated with our episode number 55 at Mises.org. And then today we'll add a couple of tools and we'll publish an updated version with this episode, which is number 62. So today we're going to talk about what are the data, what's the information that are available to entrepreneurs to design this expected value for the customer. Or I should say to inform the value proposition, because the process map says the entrepreneur's got to make a value proposition that fits well the expected value that the customer is forming in their head, positive value anticipation. So we're going to start with data gathering. And how do we get started, Mark?
Okay, so yeah, the problem entrepreneurs have to solve is that their customers can't very easily articulate what they want. Since again, like we just said, they're on a journey of learning, just like we as entrepreneurs are, right? We're trying to learn what customers will want, what customers themselves are learning what to want over time. So it's really not as simple as just asking. I've heard some entrepreneurs argue that it's just that simple. You just got to ask them. And really, it's not that easy. Now, the argument those people are making is a good one, that there's a whole lot of entrepreneurs that don't even bother asking. And that is, like they argue, a good first step, but you got to go past what consumers think they want at any given moment. And you have to try to discover what they should want, which is based in what they really need. So if they don't really know or understand what they should want or need, how can we figure that out? How can we, as Steve Jobs said, read things that are not yet on the page, if you remember that quote? And so the tools that we talked about last time, which help us to find the right customers to talk to and how to talk to them effectively, only help us accurately learn what they think they want and not what they should or will want when the time and opportunity come. And so that's what we're going to focus on right now. Now, the Austrian method helps us get closer to that. If you're not familiar with the Austrian method, it's a powerful deductive method where you start with what philosophy would call essences, some given, some real and known truths that define the real nature of things. And so long as we know the true essences of things, of something, we can deduce from that essence or those essences what those things will do in various circumstances. But the problem with this method here is we don't know our customers' essences, what makes them tick. So we can't really deduce a priori from just basic principles what our customers will do in the future. We don't have that kind of perfect knowledge of our customers, right? Because I mean, if you think about the Austrian theory of subjective value, which we talked about in our first episode, again, that says that we are all different. We have different ends or goals that motivate us. And in fact, these are underpinned by our heterogeneous needs. We all have different needs. You know, we share some strong similarities. We share the basics of these needs, right? We're all in need of hunger and warmth and love and stuff like that. But the way those manifest in different people is can be very different for each one of us.
Let's lighten up a little bit on essences, because that sounds a bit philosophical, but I think we can deal with motivations. We're trying to figure out people's motivations. Those are hidden and difficult to find. They're a little bit hidden to the individuals themselves, as you've been saying, and that's what we're trying to dig into. Let's think about what motivates them. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. Although even the motivations aren't, we can't kind of start from just given motivations mm-hmm. per se, in the sense that they're necessarily true, because we are changing our motivations right. over time. We're learning them, and so instead, this Austrian deductive method kind of fails us in this kind of sense. Although, to be fair to the Austrian method, it's not trying to tell us what we call these contingent realities. That's not the point of it. But here we need some kind of empirical method, way to empirically discover what these motivations, these consumer motivations are. And so that's what we're focusing on here. We're trying to go to the customers and learn from information, from what they can tell us, what we can observe, what they really need. But that's not at all an easy task.
No, but it is, if we collect it, as we'll discuss, it is data. It is data of a sort, not a table of numbers, but information.
Right. But what so many entrepreneurs and business managers do is they take this data and they infer from it what they think is right and just hit the ground running. And turns out they misread the data or didn't read it right, what customers really meant. And so they get themselves into problems, into trouble. And so that's what we're going to try to mitigate here. Right.
Okay.
So,
and as I understand it, we can break that down a little bit into observed behavior first, which, in a sense, is factual. We can observe it, and then we can start to interpret it. But let me not interrupt your flow. Go ahead.
No, yeah, that's good. So that's right. So, it consistent with the Austrian method and the way we understand people, there's a method in social science. It's called ethnography. And as far as I know, ethnography is the strongest technique for really digging in empirically into what people really think and believe and feel. And so that's the first tool I want to introduce here. So there's a variations of this technique, a lot of different ones, but the basic premise is that we can discover the purpose and the nature of behaviors through very careful, in-depth, and embedded observation techniques.
Yep. I'm going to emphasize a couple of things there, Mark. One is to emphasize that you pointed out behavior. So we're just looking at how people behave, although we might try to dig a little bit deeper, but it's behavior. And I'll remind people that we had a researcher on the show called Elizabeth Aniba some time ago, and I'll link to that episode as well, because she had some actual case studies of ethnography. So we've been there at least once. So
yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah, so the basic idea of ethnography is that you're going to put yourself into the situation of your customer and watch your customer while they go about their normal activities, their daily lives. And in particular, you want to embed yourself in the situation where they are experiencing the need that you are in particular interested in. Now, you might not know at this point what need you want to address. You might have kind of a ballpark. This is kind of the area I want to be in or something like that. And you can kind of focus your efforts around that. But once you're embedded in the the situation in the life of your customer, you can really observe a lot of information that you don't get from, you know, just your typical market survey or other type of market research methods. And when while you're doing this observation, it's not just watching them, you're actually talking to them and asking and prying, why are you doing this? And having them narrate kind of what's going on in their day, see if they can explain exactly what their intentions are and why they do what they do. So it's kind of like bringing your kid to work day, right? When your kid is in that obnoxious stage of always asking why over and over again, right? So yeah, why your customer would agree to let you do that, I don't know. But yeah, if you can get your customer to let you follow them around and ask why over and over again, this is a moneymaker.
Yeah, but these whys are not interpretive, right? They're just trying to uncover more facts about the behavior. You haven't started interpreting yet.
Well, at least what it gives you is the purpose that your customer, him or herself, thinks is driving their behavior. That isn't always necessarily the case that it's the true motivation, but it's how they understand their own behavior on the surface. Okay. But so when you're doing this method, this ethnography, when you're following your customer around, I really advise paying special attention to those things that your customer has a hard time explaining. And the reason why is these are areas of particular interest and opportunity for you as an entrepreneur, right? If your customers don't fully understand what they're doing or why, there's probably some inefficiencies there that they don't understand and you can potentially solve, right? Because they don't understand the current activities, they're less tied to them, to what they're doing, right? And they're probably going to be more willing to switch, right? You're easily persuaded to do something new that's hopefully better. And also because, probably more importantly, these aren't well understood activities and so aren't very easily communicated. So if you can figure it out, you're probably one of the only ones that ever has, right? If your customer doesn't understand it and can't communicate it, then no one else in the market's going to be able to really understand that if you can. So these are potential opportunities that will get you into a kind of a monopolistic position early on until other people catch up. So yeah. These are good fertile areas of opportunity.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you keep asking why until there's something that the observed customer can't explain, and then you put a green check next to that as worth investigation.
Yeah, those aren't the only opportunities. There's opportunities all over the place, but those are things I think are worth particularly paying attention to.
Okay, good. That's a great insight. Thank you.
So just to wrap that up real fast, so the idea of ethnography is you kind of keep a journal-like record of what you observe and what they tell you, and record everything you can think of as fast as you can to collect as much data and information and context as possible. And so these studies are really onerous and can take a long time, right? Because you have to actually capture several iterations of what's going on and that need that you're interested in. But it's seriously worth the time and effort because it can really help you get past those failure ideas, those ideas that you think are good, but your customer just doesn't buy into. So,
yeah, it sounds a little bit like guys in safari suits going into the jungle, a bit old fashioned, but presumably today we can use technology. We can use video and audio and counting clicks on the web and traffic cams and those kinds of things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, sure. In fact, there might be some entrepreneurial opportunity there in improving or even developing some new technology to help do such ethnographic research more efficiently and effectively with technology. But I should say, though, that you should use technology with caution. It can be very helpful here and time-saving, but there are sometimes no good substitutes for the insights and connections you can make in person, right? So a webcam can't ask your customer for clarification, for example. And might not be able to pick up some of the more subtle cues that your customer is putting off. And you can't, a webcam can't make the connection that you can in person, where it helps to open up your customer and sharing some of those more personal insights, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Position here is always that technology is not to automate, it's to augment the human. So if it makes the data collection faster and easier, it frees up the human to do more of the, as you say, the things that only humans can do in terms of asking the right questions and interpreting. So we're cool with that. We like digital tools, but ethnography is a tool, basically.
Right. So ethnography is a research method that helps us get to why they're doing what they're doing. And it doesn't tell us how they could be doing what they're doing better. You still have to use your own ingenuity to devise a better solution to whatever needs you observe. But you have to first start with getting a deep understanding of those needs that your customer is trying to solve, or may not even know he or she has, but their life would be much better off if it was solved. Much better than the existing solutions and activities they're currently doing. So, yeah, if you're having a hard time understanding what your customer really needs, or if you're not sure your customer really understands what he or she really needs, the knowledge is there. They're not acting without any purpose or reason at all. They just maybe can't put a firm finger on that purpose sometimes. But if you can find those reasons embedded in that behavior, if you look close enough, you can find those opportunities. So don't just take their word for it. You know, don't just ask and take their word for it. You can glean some really important and useful insights into those needs through extra ethnography observation, in terms of not just hearing what they think they want, but how they really live their lives. So maybe a quick example can illustrate this. Do you remember how kids' toothbrushes used to be, what they used to look like?
Yeah, skinny versions of adult toothbrushes, right?
Yeah, just those little small ones. I remember having those. There's a nice little story from Oral-B. They went to a consulting firm, I think it was IDEO, and IDEO basically told them, hey, you need to go actually watch these kids brush their teeth if you're going to figure out what to do with these kids' toothbrushes. And they thought it was silly. They thought, why do we actually have to watch kids brush their teeth? But they went ahead and did it, and they observed the kids were having a hard time handling their little toothbrushes and kept dropping them. And it dawned on them that, yeah, those kid fingers aren't as agile and dexterous as an adult. And so they can't handle those toothbrushes nearly as well. And so they redesigned the toothbrush with that very squishy, thick grip. And it was a blockbuster hit. Now, if you go down the kids aisle or the toothbrush aisle and into the kids section, you'll see every single kid toothbrush having that same design that Oral-B came up with. Right, they completely revamped that market space just from that insight by going to see kids first person.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great story. I want to underline some words that you said, and that is that reasons are embedded in the behavior. So if you can observe the behavior, you can go back to the bench and watch the movie again, and you can find the reasons in there, or you can ask the why questions, but the reasons are always there.
You can at least guess very well, infer from them some reasons. They might, it's not foolproof, but having that opportunity to see what they're doing and why, you can maybe make some important headway and breakthroughs that way. Yeah.
Okay. So your Oral-B story, that was a story that had both the observed behavior, the kids brushing their teeth and dropping the toothbrush. But it also leaped to design. They designed a better handle. So can you help us with the design part? Do the tools extend to design?
So yeah, you've kind of helped design, or if you want to use that word, design the tool that we've come up with this one. It's a journey mapping tool. If you're familiar with the journey mapping method, and it's called City of From, City of To. So you had your hand in this, but the purpose of this tool is to guide the entrepreneur in carefully observing and mapping the customer's journey, all the kind of the whole the whole road and all the pieces to that road that the customer takes in going from the city of from, what we call the city of from, which is their current experience, to the city of to, which is the destination we want to get them to, which is a better value state.
Mark is describing the city of from, city of to, innovation design and marketing tool. It's very powerful. We have an excellent version of that in our online Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey course. We've got the basic design, we've got an application, and we've got instructions for use. And it's embedded in an end-to-end process for starting, growing, and managing a business. You can find it at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to our conversation with Mark.
So yeah, that's basically what this tool is all about in a nutshell. The city of from, that's the place the customer is now in with their current routines and activities in their day. And those are what you're going to be observing. And you want to kind of map a way to get them to this, what we call the city of two, which is where they should be, should want to be, if they knew about the better way to get, if they knew about the city of two, basically.
Yeah, the place where you no longer drop toothbrushes.
Correct. Right. And so this understanding is not just necessary to designing a better solution, but it's, and this is, I think, pretty important. It's also valuable and, in fact, critical to designing an effective marketing message, right? If you can't explain to your customer why they should be in the city of two, why they should want to be there, then they're not going, right? They're more comfortable in their routine, right? So you've got to be able to understand their problems in a way that you can explain it to them such that they understand it and kind of that aha bulb comes on and they're like, oh yes, I definitely need what you've got. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we're big believers that the message is part of the solution, an integral part, an important part. It's not separate or added on later. It's part of the solution.
So I think we've got this city of from, city of to tool all in our entrepreneurial toolbox for the course that we're working on. But I think there's already a preview of it already on Mises.org.
There isn't one right now, but there is one in our Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey course, and I'll put one in the show notes so that people can see how it works.
Awesome.
Good. So we're in the city of two, or at least we've mapped the city of from and the city of two where people are going to go. So that's, we're calling that part of data collection. It's just a way of organizing the data collection, but we've still got the challenge of we've got the where the customer is, where they want to go. We've observed their behavior. We've listened to their frustrations. But we still got to interpret all of this in a way that gets us to commerce, gets us to produce something that they will buy. And we've still got the customer not articulating what they want. So we've got some interpretation and translation to do. So can you take us there? Can you tell us how to interpret some of this data through that process?
Right. So you're basically talking about that inference problem and the issue with going from what we see to what your customer's really feeling and needing, which has that inference problem. We're really starting to kind of just guess. So this is where empathy, what we call entrepreneurial empathy in particular, becomes vital. So recently, entrepreneurship scholars have come to recognize that entrepreneurs succeed only to the extent that they empathize with their customers and that their empathy is accurate, right? So we call this empathic accuracy. To the extent that your empathy with your customer is accurate, you're more likely to give them something that will work for them. So it takes empathy to interpret another's actions and their experience in a way that makes sense to you, in a way that you can kind of use that knowledge successfully. So empathy is actually an imagination skill. It's basically imagining what it's like for them and through that imagination, feeling as they must feel, which is not at all an easy skill. In fact, you know, there's some really interesting research in marketing that shows that managers and entrepreneurs are more often than not wrong about what they think their customers think and want. But it is a skill that you can learn. But it takes understanding first what empathy really is, and also it takes some practice. So we can help you with the first part, and you're going to have to do the practice on your own.
Well, let's just ask Mark, is that position controversial? Is it controversial that you can learn empathy? Is it really a skill?
So kind of, yes. So if you look at the empathy research, it's all over the place. There are so many disagreements even about what we even mean by empathy. So there's all kinds of definitions of empathy. There's arguments over how empathy works and why it works. But there has been some good recent research that suggests that empathy can be trained, and I'm working currently on a couple projects, trying to understand better what we really mean by empathy and how it works. And so, so I've got some insights from that research that are probably worth sharing with our entrepreneurs.
Take us in there. Take us deeper.
Okay. So let's start with what empathy really is and how we do it, which, in reality, we don't and can't really see from another's perspective or even feel another's feelings, because those are subjective and individual. So what we can do is imagine what it is like for another person. And that's what we mean by empathy, right? So empathy is actually an imagination. It's counterfactual rational imagination is kind of the technical term for that. But let's talk about what that means.
Imagination, just to clarify the word, it's active, right? Sometimes you can think of imagination as you're not paying attention and your mind is wandering. You're talking about an active, reason-based performance of a task of imagining.
Right. So we use our imagination for basically almost all of our mental activities, right? When you are remembering even, you're reimagining what you did in the past, those activities. And so you get to experience in your imagination that memory, that activity that happened in the past. And you can sometimes, when you do that imagination, re-experience it with all the feelings and the excitement and stuff. And then again, with reason, with deduction, you're using your imagination. It's kind of hard to explain this, but the way your brain works is you've got this mental model of reality that I call knowledge. Some call knowledge something else, but in my research, I'm calling this mental model of reality what we know, what our knowledge is. So this mental model is our worldview. It's how we see the world and how it works. Some researchers have called it a small world representation, right? As if reality were this kind of mini world in our minds of how it all works. It has all of our memories, what we've already learned, and we've organized all these memories and observations into this coherent theoretical framework, which is our worldview. This is how the world works. This is our theory of how the pieces fit together. And so when we learn new things, we add to this mental model, we keep adding little pieces to it. And when something new comes in, we have to theorize anew, why did this happen and how did it work? Are you familiar with the term mental crisis?
No, I'm not specifically, but it doesn't sound good.
A mental crisis, yeah. So a mental crisis happens when you basically confront some new information that you can't fit into your mental model. And so one easy way to deal with this is to just reject it, to dismiss it as an anomaly, or it's just bad data or something like that. But if you can't, or if you don't want to, if you find this new information compelling and it's not fitting into your mental model, well, this creates this mental crisis. We have to completely overhaul our mental model, right? Sometimes we say this, it's turned our whole world upside down. And that's what we mean, is we've got to reinterpret our whole worldview and mm-hmm. develop a new worldview. This kind of mental model reconstruction can be pretty painful and taxing, but we've all maybe not all of us, but most of us have had to do this. We've had this type of mental crisis where we've become confronted with our beliefs, and had to revise them, significantly at one time or other in our lives. Right. So, I mean, for example, you and I, probably came to the Austrian school and the Mises Institute through some kind of mental crisis like this, right? We're like, oh, this explains reality better than what I used to believe.
Yeah, I used to call it unlearning what they taught me.
Yeah, right. Okay, so this mental model of reality is the logic behind all of the way we think, right? I think the best way to explain it or think about it is as a simulator. So we put inputs into our mental model and run those inputs, simulate them through our mental model to its conclusion, to its logical conclusion, right? So giving the assumptions, the way we understand the world to work, if I put this input in, this would be the logical conclusion from that, right? So again, remembering goes through that the simulation of those past experiences. But also when we do reasoning, we make deductions, we're putting inputs into our mental model, and based on our theoretical world, output what that would be and draw some logical conclusion from that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, it's the same imaginative process, that simulation process, to make a prediction or a judgment, right? To form some kind of expectation of what will be or what could be. And I want to focus on that could word in particular, because that's a counterfactual.
Mm-hmm.
What could be if things were maybe different, or if this happened, right? So most of our listeners probably have heard of counterfactuals, but what if you haven't, what we mean by a counterfactual is an alternative reality. So if we replaced our mental model of reality with an alternative, then we can use that simulation of an alternative reality to come up with different kind of false reality conclusions, right? So what might have been if things had happened differently? What could be if I choose this action instead of that one? Or what if the sky were red? What would the world be like? You know, we can actually imagine those things. But those are all counterfactuals. Those are alternative realities that are not the real one that we believe to be true, which is our mental model.
And so when we ask customers or consumers, potential customers, to consider and try some new service that we're offering and to change what they're doing, we're essentially asking them to upend their mental model. Is that what we're saying?
Well, it's not necessarily upend their mental model, but we are asking them to do some counterfactual thinking, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If instead of using the product that you are used to using, you used this product, how would your life be different? So they are imagining, and that's that predictive value step in that value cycle. We're having them predict this value using counterfactual imagination.
Okay.
But where I'm going with this is counterfactual imagination is the process of empathy.
Yeah.
Process by which we empathize.
Mm-hmm. We're interpreting somebody else's mental model.
Right, exactly. So we're taking someone else's reality and we're trying to reconstruct it in our own minds as if we were them, and play out the scenario, the experience that they've experienced, using that artificial, our creation of that mental model that is supposed to be theirs, right? So we're simulating their experience as if it were our own. This doesn't mean that we are putting ourselves in their shoes, in the sense that we're not kind of saying, the question is not, what would I do in their situation? What empathy really means is, what are they feeling themselves in their own situation, which is kind of different. That's the difference, if you want to be technical, between what we call perspective taking and empathy.
If when a person uses in conversation a phrase like, I can see how you might feel that way, that's a way of putting ourselves in empathetically into their mental model.
Yeah, well, it's at least at a minimum perspective taking, but yeah, that sounds like empathy. But what the goal of empathy is to actually feel what your customer is feeling, or at least get a glimpse of that feeling so that you can understand it, so that you can kind of get to a deeper level of understanding and be able to address it in a way that they are happy with, right? So this is where a lot of entrepreneurs go wrong, because they're looking at a problem through their own mental model, through their own perspective, mm-hmm. and saying, okay, if I was in their shoes, if that was me, this is what I would do. And so this is a better solution. But that is a recipe for failure, because it doesn't matter what you would do. It matters what your customer would do in that situation. So you have to understand it from their perspective.
Yeah, it sounds awfully hard to feel what somebody else is feeling. But what I hear you saying is you imagine you can feel what they are feeling.
Right. Okay. And imagination is actually based in knowledge, right? The way I define knowledge is that mental model of reality. And so, in other words, the way to improve your empathy with your customer is to refine and elaborate and perfect the artificial mental model that you have that represents your customer's world, their mental model. So if you can improve that, if you can make that a very very perfect one, you can't ever get perfect, but if you can improve that mental model, you will end up improving your empathy. So the goal of the tool and the theory that we're working on in this project is to help figure out what you need to learn from your customer in terms of knowledge that would improve your empathy. And there are two parts or two types of knowledge that matter for the way you empathize. The first is simply knowledge about your customer, right? Who they are, what they're like, right? Their personality, their nature, their beliefs, their preferences, mm-hmm. and so forth, right? So you can learn all this information to a large extent through just going up and asking them and, observing and whatever other market research you can do. So do plenty of that. You want to learn as much as you can about your customer before you empathize. And the second type of knowledge is personal experiential knowledge. So it's their memories about past personal experiences and what those experiences were like, what it felt like, and what those experiences meant to your customer, right? But this type of knowledge is what we call tacit. And tacit means it's not easily communicated. Mm-hmm. Can I spend a second explaining tacit knowledge?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. There's a famous paper by Thomas Nagel in 1974 entitled, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? Mm-hmm. And the purpose of this thought experiment is basically, he concludes, you cannot know what it's like to be a bat. You can imagine what it's like for yourself to behave as a bat behaves, to be blind, to use echolocation, to be able to fly. You can imagine yourself in that situation, but it is impossible, at least Nagel argues, and I think he's probably right, it's impossible to know exactly what it's like for a bat to be a bat.
And because we don't have the bat's mental model, right?
No, yeah, we don't. And that's the same problem for empathy, right? When I assume you know how to ride a bike?
Yes, I do.
Good. So when someone was teaching you how to ride a bike, they probably spent a lot of time explaining, this is what you do. You pedal and you have to turn the handlebars to keep your balance and stuff like that. There are pieces of an experience, of a learning process that you can explain, but things like learning how to ride a bike, You cannot learn just from explanation. You have to try it yourself. You have to experience it yourself, yeah. Right? And that is what we call tacit knowledge, right? It's this experience-based knowledge that has to be firsthand. And that knowledge that you gain from it is embedded in that experience. It's the same reason why you can't ever explain to someone else what salt tastes like. You should You should try it sometime. It's pretty funny.
Tastes salty, I guess. Yeah. But so an entrepreneur in trying to understand this customer experience, I think I hear you saying you can't actually do it. You just got to get closer and closer and imagine it in your own mind.
Well, so there's a few things you can do to get far closer to a good empathic mental model, that artificial mental model that represents your customer, right? So, so this is actually another reason, good reason why ethnography really helps with this, because when you share experiences, when you are in the same place, when you are embedded in the same culture and life, you get these shared experiences that really help with your ability to communicate with other people that have those same experiences, right? So there's a lot of really good research, very compelling research, that shows that close friends and family members are way better at empathizing with each other than people that are unfamiliar with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's because they've spent a lot of time together. They understand each other. They've had a lot of shared experiences. They've got the same culture and worldview. They've got inside information, inside jokes, and understand all of those things about each other. And so when one of them says something or is experiencing something, the other person can kind of see it through that other person's worldview, because they have a solid and strong understanding of what that worldview is. And so if you can get that with your customer, you will be at a huge advantage in terms of understanding really what they're saying and what they mean. So entrepreneurial empathy entails understanding your customer that you're empathizing with. And to do that, we've got a few recommendations of things you can do. So first, just as I said, you're going to empathize most with people of similar experience. That doesn't necessarily mean you should only seek out those people that are very similar to you. If you remember from, was it the last time we talked? What you really want are lead users. Those are the people you want to seek out.
Yeah, I remember that.
But if you can find lead users that have a very similar life experience to you, then that's awesome. Those are the people that are going to be easiest for you to understand and talk to. But if you can't find those types of people, there's a couple other things you can do. If you've got a team, you might find the person on your team that is has the closest life experience to that, to a particular lead user, and send them to do the empathizing, right? If that makes sense. In fact, if you do have a team, I suggest you use all of your team members in that way. Go talk to, for lack of a better term, go talk to your people, the people that you have kind of grown up with and understand, and talk to them, and you can empathize best with those.
The shared experience, yeah.
And second, you can really learn a lot about another person over time by embedding yourself in their culture, in their situation, right? So you can spend time with them, or in their geography, in their culture, in their experience, and come to figure out a lot of the meaning and experience in that customer's experience that way.
Yep. Okay. Understood. I remember from my years of working in the beer business, we used to be white collar type people, I think, and we didn't necessarily understand the blue collar workers who were drinking the beer back then. And we spent a lot of time with them. We came up with the idea of what we call blue collar heroes, that the person who's laying concrete, when they've laid the concrete perfectly and it's perfectly level and the spirit level tells them it's the case and the edges are clean and everything is wonderful, they get a heroic kind of feeling from doing their job really well. And it's the kind of thing that we didn't understand as marketing executives. So we learned a lot that way. And that was, we didn't call it ethnography, but I think that's what it was.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a great example. It's pretty impressive once you really follow people and what their life is like to see that, because everybody's life is so different that we just don't understand from our kind of isolated perspective that it really does matter to embed yourself in that situation to understand it.
So Mark, I think you also said there's a knowledge framework that can help entrepreneurs pull all this together and solve what you called the learning problem, the problem that we have knowledge to get that we can't really easily get. So tell us what that framework is.
I call it the Customer Knowledge Generation Framework, or CKG. And really, it's basically a framework to interpret as accurately as possible your communications and observations with your customers. So one important point to note is that when you communicate with your customer, all that your customer can share with you is information. They cannot share their knowledge, which again is their mental map, their mental model, right? Mm-hmm. It's like your bike riding skill. They can't share that knowledge. All they can share is information about it. And then you have to kind of infer from that the best you can through your empathy. And so there's a lot of pitfalls that entrepreneurs and market researchers and businessmen fall into that cause them to mislearn what their customers really need from these communications. So I've got the CKG in five steps. And with those five steps, there's five pitfalls. They can be summarized as five pitfalls.
Okay.
So the first step is customer learning, which is really what we've talked about the first couple of episodes. So basically, again, customers don't themselves perfectly know what they need, and they're learning as they go. And so you can be misled. You can fall into a pitfall of assuming that customers know what they need when they really don't. So again, what we talked about last time was choosing the right customers to talk to. And we've got a tool for that in from a previous episode. The second step is in the CKG is your customer's motivation for sharing that information, right? They're going to not share very much information if they don't have a reason to, right? They're not going to spend that time talking to you and giving you all this detailed knowledge and letting you follow them around if there's not something in it for them. So they need to see the purpose in their talking to, right? And just offering them a monetary reward, paying them up, isn't necessarily the way you want to go, because it should be intrinsic motivation. So what you really want to do to manage or avoid this pitfall is get them excited in what you're doing. Help them see the end game, that this is going to change their lives and solve their problems. The third step is the entrepreneur's motivation to learn, right? A lot of entrepreneurs just don't understand that the need to really get down that deep into the customer's psyche and motivations. But you do. And so don't just go through the motions, and the effort that you put into learning will have a large effect on the amount of and the accuracy of the knowledge that you get from the customer and the accuracy of it. Just for the interest of time, let's keep going. Fourth, the fourth step is the communication process itself. And communication is just fraught with noise and distortions and information loss and stuff like that, right?
Are we talking about the customers communicating to us when we're doing ethnography, or us communicating to them, or both?
Right. Mostly we're talking about actual communications through messages, through speaking. But there's also information loss and in observational types of communications. The CKG focuses on actual verbal or written communications, but you can draw from it similar principles for observation.
Okay.
And so, you know, if you've ever sent a text message without an emoji, and your wife misinterprets that and gets all mad at you.
Sounds like it happened to you.
Maybe once or twice. That's what's going on, right? It's hard to convey the true meaning of messages in communication without some information loss of what you really meant. So lots of opportunity for misunderstanding there. And so better communication methods, and again, the ethnography tool that we talked about can help here. But even if you receive perfect information, interpreting that information and inferring from it a reconstructive vision of what that experience really feels like for the customer, and learning from that empathic experience is full of other pitfalls, right? So our counterfactual model might be flawed. And so from that flawed model, we'll empathize wrong, we'll not feel what they feel, we'll feel something different and draw wrong inferences. Or when we receive information, we actually tend to be pretty selective in what we think matters in what people tell us or show us. So we tend to dismiss a lot of information that we do get, and we just think it's not important. And so because we're selective in what we find meaningful and what we learn from, we introduce all these potential biases, and this can skew what we learn, and we will end up dismissing things not worth remembering, we think, which can cause misinterpretations. But our empathy tool should help a lot with that. So yeah, again, a lot of potential for errors when communicating with customers, but knowing and understanding these potential pitfalls can help us avoid them, and the CKG tool can really help solve these learning problems.
Can the entrepreneur go back to the customer and say, here's what I think I heard, here's what I think I learned, here's my interpretation of it, did I get it right? Is that a useful technique?
Yes. Yes, it is. In fact, we do have a tool to kind of help us do this. I don't think we're going to talk about this today, but I think we will have it in our course. We do have a tool to kind of go back and make sure our understanding matches up with their understanding of the need and our solution, so that we're on the same page. Because if you're not, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So
okay,
it's worth going back and double checking.
Yep. Good. Well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We'll do that next time. But I'm looking at the clock. I think let's wrap up there. There's a lot more ground to cover in this value learning process, but I want to make sure that we package it up in consumable units. So let's stop there for today, Mark. So you've brought us to the threshold, if you like, of designing solutions, of helping customers to make predictive valuations that are favorable and appropriate. We're fully armed with the amount of knowledge and insight that we can get. We'll put it into the design process and facilitate value that way. But let's wrap up today in terms of data collection. So we're observing. We'll ask some questions while we're there, but it's not interpretive. We're just observing. From the observed behavior, we're going to try and deduce the motivations. And we got the City of Two tool that might help us figure out where they might want to go. And we get deeper into what customers really need with our empathy and our consumer knowledge gathering tool. So is that the right way to package up what we said today?
Yeah. Yeah. So the point of all of this is to ensure to the largest extent possible that you, the entrepreneur, And what you decide to do delivers real and meaningful value to your customers, that you'll satisfy them and even delight them, hopefully, right? That's the only ticket to sustained success, right? You could be the best salesman in the world, but if you don't deliver real value to your customers, if all you have is snake oil, you can only be a flash in the pan at best. Even if you think your snake oil works, it doesn't matter what you think. It only matters what's valuable to your customer. So if you can really learn what they truly need, if you can facilitate real value, then you've got something that will grow and last.
Good. Well, thank you. Yeah, we'll keep our eyes on that prize, and we'll update the model for the information that you gave us today. We'll post that on episode number 62 page. We'll provide a City of From, City of To tool outline and some how to use it instructions. And next time when we get you back, hopefully soon, we'll get into how to shape those expectations appropriately in the consumer's mind. So, Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me again.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.